Hey, everybody, it's Anne. Street protests are continuing across the country. Police departments are enacting changes. Confederate statues are coming down. What's next in the fight for Black equality? This hour, we'll take a hard look at how racism infects not only the police, but the entire criminal justice system. Keep listening.
Wisconsin Public Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search. Just match with Indeed. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/the best. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. American streets are ringing with calls to reform or defund the police, with demands for real equal justice. But bad cops are just the tip of the iceberg.
Take a big step back. Take a big step back. And look what we've done.
Because more often than not, if you're African American and you get arrested, you don't go home. This is Michelle Alexander.
When a young person is caught with some marijuana in their pocket, or a little cocaine, or whatever it is that young people find themselves experimenting with, young people of all colors, if a young person in the hood is caught with that, their life is over. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination that we associate with the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again. Employment discrimination is legal. Housing discrimination against you is legal. Under federal law, you're deemed ineligible for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. In a growing number of states, you're expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And paying back all these fees, fines, and court costs may be a condition of your probation or parole. We went from a prison population in the 1970s of about 300,000 to now one of well over 2 million. Our system of mass incarceration operates more like a system of racial and social control than a system of crime prevention and control.
Ten years ago, civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander wrote The New Jim Crow, the book that exposed the racial caste system built into American criminal justice. It still required reading, but there's a new question that's been getting attention lately. Should we abolish prisons? Ruth Wilson Gilmore is a scholar and activist. She directs the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the City University of New York. And for three decades, she's been building a nuanced, historically grounded argument for prison abolition. She says, when you put mass incarceration in a larger context, it's pretty clear. You don't solve a problem by repeating the kind of behavior that brought you the problem in the first place.
Look at the United States. It's not like anywhere else in the world when it comes to prisons and jails. Not like anywhere in the world.
We have more?
Way more. Way more. In absolute numbers and rate. Way more than anywhere on the planet.
Why is that?
Well, because, among other things, the United States, in the various kinds of jurisdictions that add up to the criminal justice system, which is incredibly varied, right? 52 plus, 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 plus jurisdictions, plus all the counties with all the jails and all the municipalities with all of their jails, have over time tended to replace the once kind of creaky but extant welfare state with a punishment regime. Meaning, in other words, that problems that could be addressed in a variety of ways become the foundation for defining crimes and then defining punishment.
This is such an important point you make in your work, and I don't feel like I have completely wrapped my head around it. I think that the picture you're describing is one in which almost incrementally and invisibly, the apparatus that was established when, after World War II, for public education, public housing, social welfare, little by little by little, somehow turned more into a system for imprisoning people. Am I getting it right? And how did that happen?
Yes. For a brief time in the history of the United States, in the middle of the 20th century, large banks and corporations agreed to tax themselves at very high rates, and indeed wealthy individuals had no choice but to agree, go along with this agreement. And that money went into tax coffers as what I call the social wage, which is the wage not paid out to individual workers, but put into a public coffer for public purposes. And that money then went back out into expanded, for example, public education. But in the mid and late 1960s, another thing that happened was in the overdeveloped world, the rate of profit started to fall. And it was just the rate. Nothing was becoming unprofitable. I mean, the Ford Motor Company was profitable and Chase Bank was profitable. So where could they cut costs? They could cut costs by tightening the opportunities for workers to organize, and they could cut costs by cutting their taxes. So they cut costs by cutting taxes very deliberately and methodically over time. And the argument was, well, the problem is the government and the solution is to shrink it. Now, if anybody would take a moment of nerdly time and look at the size of, say, expenditures for government operations over time, you see nothing shrank, but what did wither was the scale and the scope of what we call the welfare state. So there's the dollars and cents part of it. But then still, you say, well, why not just abandon everybody? Why criminalize people and lock them up? And as far as I've been able to tell, the problem with running for office on a promise that you're going to get rid of government is, if you win, then you are government. So the question is, are you going to win and then say, now I resign and I'm going to turn off the lights and there will be no government? Or when you win, do you say, well, there are some things, everybody who elected me, you will agree I can legitimately continue to do. War and policing.
Crime.
Yes, war and crime.
Mm-hmm.
War and crime. And crime as the problem for which prison is the solution became a really key legitimating factor for people elected in a number of states. One of the dilemmas that many elected and appointed officials faced in a number of states, California among them, was the fact that many people in prison in California and Texas and Louisiana and Michigan and elsewhere had successfully waged court cases in the federal courts contesting conditions of confinement and the legality of their sentences, whether the punishment was cruel and unusual. And the courts regularly found on behalf of prisoners and ordered the states to fix things. But later on, as a result of, again, many of these decisions, state legislatures changed the law. Mandatory minimums, the discretion of judges declined significantly. Over time, as the prison systems in a variety of states became bigger and bigger and bigger and built new buildings to solve the problems of conditions of confinement, say, look, here's a nice, fresh, new, not nasty prison, as though any prison could really be not nasty. And meanwhile, then, crime and punishment became more and more a part of everybody's life in ways that were not directly associated with whether or not somebody in your household, say, was arrested, taken to court, tried, and convicted.
What do you mean became more a part of everybody's life?
Great question. For example, schools had a harder and harder time hiring not only enough teachers, classroom teachers, but also the kind of support staff you need to run a school, counselors and so on and so
forth. School nurses, administrators.
And so what some school districts did was they turned to the legitimizing possibility of saying, we'll put police in schools to hire people who would have, say, double jobs. So somebody who would come in to be a career counselor who was also a school officer. In other words, they were absorbing into the institution of public education some of the practices, and I think, whether consciously or not, the legitimacy that police and jails and prison had.
Would you say that that actually affected the culture of schools? Because having raised two kids and having gone to public schools myself, I mean, anybody who's been in them, you do kind of feel like you're a prisoner.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Damien Sojourner, wrote a fantastic book about kids in schools, just in a normal working class school in Long Beach, California, where he taught as a substitute teacher, and it was his field work as an anthropologist. He was shocked by how much the kids seemed already prepared to do time. That for him, the entire kind of organization of the school, the fact that you go in through the medical scanners, that there are a lot of uniformed police around, the rules to which everybody had to submit to be in the classroom.
The way doors open and close, you come in, the door closes behind you, you cannot leave until a teacher says you can leave to go to the bathroom, you have to get a hall pass. I mean, it's a very regimented life.
Very regimented. And the kids were, again, seemed like what they were learning was how to do time.
Over and over again, when you talk about the increase in prisons, so often the case is made, we really need a new prison here. Terrible overcrowding. But the point you make is that so often what happens is if you build it, they will come. You open up this gorgeous new prison. It's going to be bigger than you think you will need. And within what? I don't know, a few months, it's full. So can you tease that out for me? I mean, it sounds like you're saying you build an empty prison and somehow that causes a rise in incarcerations.
In a way, it does. I know that sounds like I subscribe to conspiracy theories, and I don't. What I do is I count things and I think about why numbers change the way they do. So, for example, in California, the state I still know best, the counties where people are tried and convicted saw that they could charge higher than they had been charging and send people into the system. And there was just this constant build, fill, build, fill. If we go back through the history of the even establishment of the California state prison system, we see that the very first prison that was built in California, which was San Quentin, opened in 1852. It was designed for some small number of people. All the sheriffs were told, bring us whoever you don't want. And it was overcrowded the first day.
So we've talked a lot about the economics and underlying structural reasons for the kind of prison proliferation we've seen in this country. What about your moral argument for getting rid of prisons?
The moral argument for getting rid of prisons. I guess it's got two parts. I think this is a moral argument. The first one is that human beings should not be sitting in cages. And the second thing is, let's say the state or the government models behavior for the polity. And if the way that those who have, as we like to say, legitimate use of violence, and therefore those who control the forces of organized violence, say that the only way to deal with problems is to use the threat of violence, then that will proliferate out, in my view, in how people solve problems that have nothing to do with the government.
So again, we're talking about a social spread. You know, mm-hmm. violence is a kind of contagion.
Exactly.
That spreads through our entire, as you say, polity.
Yeah.
If I ask you to imagine a world without prisons, what does that look like to you?
I imagine a world in which nobody goes hungry, nobody goes without shelter, where education is universally available and free to everyone. No one who is a child is dependent on the people whose sexual activity produced them for their care and nurturing, even if those people are the ones who want to take care of them. No elderly person worries about eating cat food or not eating. And it's something that is essentially green, which is to say has a strong sensibility about the interconnection and interdependence of all life on this planet, meaning that capitalism will not be productive of abolition ever. It will only be at best industrial democracy, the sort that Du Bois wrote about 90 years ago.
The one word you didn't use is criminal.
No, of course I didn't use criminal.
We're talking about prisons.
I know we're talking about prisons. I don't write about crime. I write about prisons. So the question is that underlies criminal, what are you going to do, Ruthie Gilmore, if somebody hurts somebody? Well, there are lots of people in all kinds of situations all around the world who work very directly and effectively on interrupting the kinds of relations that are conducive to people hurting other people.
But what about, I mean, you can't always prevent everything.
No, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't. That is true. That is true. But criminalization hasn't been preventing anything either.
Yeah.
We need something else.
I mean, you're not right? saying if you build a wonderful world, there won't be any crime, nobody will ever hurt anybody else.
But I'm saying it's less likely. It's so less likely.
Ruth Wilson Gilmore directs the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the City University of New York. She wrote a landmark book on the California prison system called The Golden Gulag, and she's about to come out with her next, Change Everything, Racial Capitalism and the Case for Abolition. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
My Dangerous Idea is about how to overcome mass imprisonment and excessive punishment in America. It's been a long
time coming, but I know. This is Brian Stevenson, the legal rights advocate and author of the best-selling memoir, Just Mercy. His idea? Enlist the forces of capitalism to end mass incarceration.
Our prison population has gone from 300,000 in 1972 to 2.3 million today. We've got 6 million people on probation and parole, 68 million Americans with criminal arrests. I think that we could radicalize our commitment to helping people recover from the mistakes they make if we began to incentivize our vast infrastructure of jails and prisons to actually pick up the challenge of rehabilitation, of restoration, of recovery. What I'd like to do is to create financial prizes for the prisons that release people who have the lowest recidivism rate. I'd like to reward correctional employees who find ways to inspire and educate and empower the people who are in prison and incarcerated under their supervision to leave prison and never come back. I think you'd see a very different prison system emerge. You wouldn't have the indifference to what happens. You wouldn't tolerate the abuse and misjudgments and mistreatment. You'd actually have people pulling together to find ways to help people stay free from drugs and alcohol dependency, stay free from the violence and the environments that create despair and suffering. We ought to be creating the incentives, and I don't have a problem making them financial incentives, to turn the prison industrial complex into something that's more like the redemption industrial complex, where we actually invest in changing lives rather than throwing lives away. I think we've just abandoned rehabilitation in ways that have left us really vulnerable. And we now see this revolving door where lots of communities are just being fractured by the way in which there is no stability or security or public safety. So yes, I think we need to reorient ourselves to a new concept of justice that really is rooted in helping people recover.
The redemption industrial complex. That just might be the phrase of the year. Brian Stevenson founded the Equal Justice Initiative and wrote about it in his best-selling memoir, Just Mercy. By the way, the film version is free on Amazon for the month of June, so check it out. Long time coming, but I know. The statistics are clear. African Americans are imprisoned at 5 times the rate of white Americans. So how did we get here? Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad says it begins with America's fear of black men, a fear so long-standing and so pervasive, we barely notice it. And so where did that toxic stereotype of the black male criminal come from? Well, Muhammad tells Steve Paulson that ironically, tragically, you can trace it back to emancipation and the end of the Civil War.
So you've got 4 million people who had in a historical blink of the eye gone from being enslaved to free. And the question was, how do they fit? What are they capable of? What is the quality of their contribution to society? And it just so happened this was a moment for the emergence of what we think of as sociology today, or more generally, the social sciences. So there was a lot of focus on demographics and health and mortality rates and essentially ranking various groups, largely European immigrants, like African Americans, into categories of fitness and what kinds of contributions would they make. So that was the larger context in which this question of criminality emerged.
So there were crime statistics that were used to promote this idea of black criminality.
Yes, but more particularly, it wasn't obvious that that would be a signpost for black people's fitness in modern life. A couple of innovative demographers noted that African Americans were disproportionately represented in the nation's prisons 1 generation after slavery. The number was roughly 30% of 82,000, and that number represented a nearly 3 times overrepresentation of African Americans who were only 12% of the general population.
This sounds like a very familiar story today.
It is a very familiar story. And what's interesting about it is, while we know what that means to a lot of people, back then, someone had to explain it. Someone had to make meaning of it. And it was in that origins moment, the use of crime statistics in the U.S. Census, 1 generation after slavery, particularly the 1890 census, set in motion a set of ideas that are in circulation today and essentially justify certain forms of discriminatory treatment, both explicitly within our criminal justice systems, as well as in general society.
Well, you write about this association between blackness and criminality as, to some degree, the work of a demographer named Frederick Hoffman. Why was he so significant?
He's really the first person to make a big deal about this. He's the first person to look at the U.S. Census data in 1890, see the disproportionate rates of African Americans in prisons at that time, and write about it in such a way that others took note, and he started a trend. And that trend essentially said that in the aftermath of slavery, crime statistics among African Americans prove that they are, one, inferior, two, retreating or reverting to an ancestral state closer to savagery than to citizens, and should be subjected to different standards of justice as a result.
So how should those crime statistics have been interpreted if sociologists really knew what they were doing?
Looking back, we could say that turns out a significant number of African Americans were subject to new forms of racial surveillance and social control. In other words, that 30% number would have a gigantic asterisk or footnote attached to it saying, we have no idea how much racism there was in the 1870s and 80s that produced this number, but we know it was a whole lot. Therefore, this number can't be taken at face value. The other thing that actually happened in that moment was you had significant rates of homicide, crimes of poverty and property, underground participation in drug markets by European immigrant groups, largely Italians, Irish, Polish, Catholics. Their crime statistics were through the roof in many cities, and people we come to know as progressives, those who were essentially liberals, arguing that inequality was the basis for social disorder in the nation's leading cities at the time, explained the crime statistics.
So the difference there was Black people were considered as sort of innately violent, whereas there were kind of environmental reasons why these white immigrants committed crimes.
That's right. There was a gigantic footnote attached to the European immigrants' crime and none attached to African Americans. One spoke for itself. The other one had a very long explanation.
Now, there were critics back then of Hoffman's work. W.E.B. Du Bois was a big critic of his research, wasn't he?
Du Bois was the first African American to really gain status as a national expert on the Black urban condition and race in general. He actually writes in an 1898 article on the study of the American Negro, a response to Hoffman's work, because he sees it as incredibly dangerous. He describes Hoffman as essentially doing drive-by sociology, that no foreigner can simply look at census data and put his finger on the pulse of a problem.
Of course, the other side of this whole discussion of criminality is how it plays out in law enforcement and policing, a subject that is on everyone's mind these days. Are there parallels to what was going on back then?
It would be impossible not to find a moment if you read the daily newspapers of Philadelphia, of Chicago, of New York, of Cleveland and Detroit, and not see stories that sound identical to the problem of stop and frisk today, or even the idea of broken windows, that is, policing low-level status offenses. When Black people stepped outside of the prescribed areas, they were subjected to forms of heavy-handed, often brutal policing that sent a message that you are out of place, you are not welcome here. So the form of policing that evolved in the North evolved not only in direct relationship to these ideas articulated through crime statistics, but also through the way in which the city itself evolved in the North, which was very different than what segregation looked like in the South.
So the kinds of questions about inequality that we're dealing with today, racial profiling, differences in the length of sentencing, were those talked about back then as well?
By the late 1920s, the work of people like Du Bois or Ida B. Wells, people like that helped to reshape the debate among American criminologists, white criminologists like Edwin Sutherland and Thorsten Sellin, who were two of the leading criminologists of the period. They were swayed by the arguments of their Black counterparts, and they too noted excessive police activity in the Black community amongst innocent people. They noted a disproportionate sentencing of African Americans for crimes that whites similarly engaged in, and began to call crime statistics a legal fiction or evidence of the legal fictions of equality. That was a significant breakthrough in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
So you're saying that there were critics of the criminal justice system, of policing procedures, of African Americans being targeted, going back at least a century. which does raise the question, why hasn't there been more progress since then?
Well, sometimes beliefs trump data. It didn't matter that you had counter evidence. Can I give you a really good example?
Sure.
In the 1922 report of the Negro in Chicago, it was one of the first Blue Ribbon commissions to study the outcome of a race riot. What they found was not only that there was so much racism in the criminal justice system that crime statistics were essentially useless, but they also had direct testimony from judges, from police officers, from district attorneys, all whites, saying that when we come across African Americans, we treat them differently because we are afraid that if we don't control them, we'll lose track of them. In other words, we keep a close eye on them and we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. So this was a major admission within a major sociological report on a major riot in a major city, Chicago, over 100 years ago, and it made very little long-term difference.
So let's bring this story up to the present now. You know, huge national debate about all of these issues that we've been talking about. Is there something new going on right now, or are we just replaying the story that you've been describing that goes back at least 100 years?
It's a little bit of both. So on one hand, there is a long tradition of fighting racial violence, if we think of it in the broadest sense, whether it's by an individual citizen or by a police officer. What we did not see, however, was that the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s did not make attacking racism in the criminal justice system as a core pillar of its work, which is to say what we are potentially seeing is the first national movement directed explicitly to the criminal justice system as a civil rights movement, not about racial violence, but about criminal justice.
We've been talking about this really depressing history, frankly, of, you know, how a lot of these problems we're very aware of today go way back, and people talked about them back then. It does raise the question of, you know, what can we do?
Well, we start telling a different story of who we are as a nation. We've never really come to terms with our racial legacy. We treat it as an aberration. But the truth is that America can't be America without having had slavery. So these are things that your listeners are already saying, what does that have to do with changing the circumstances of today? But that's precisely the point. We have a deep aversion to a full reckoning with our history. And it doesn't have to make us feel bad, but it is the necessary precondition for holding ourselves accountable when we do slide into the past from the present and start to see things that are far too eerily familiar. So education and how we teach matters greatly to this.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. And he's a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. And that was Steve Paulson talking with him. And now, if you're looking for something else to read to help you understand this moment and how we got here, here's someone whose recommendations are always worth taking.
Hi, my name is Malcolm Gladwell. I am the host of Revisionist History Podcast.
Black male, gray shirt, blue pants.
The book I would like to recommend is a book by a criminologist named Frank Zimring called When Police Kill, which is very much timely. I ran across it. It was one of these, I don't know, I hope it sells many, 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 many hundreds of thousands of copies now. But at the time, it was a kind of a book by an academic. And he basically systematically tried to figure out how many people die at the hands of police in the United States, how does that compare to other countries, and why? Why do people, so many people die at the hands of police in the United States? It's completely dispassionate. It is not a work of advocacy. It's a work of analysis. And he walks you through, it's just this kind of education in this problem. He's an older man. He's been one of the leading criminologists in the world for decades. He's written many, many books, many of which I've read, and I've always come away from reading his books profoundly smarter than I was before I started. So he wrote a book about New York, about the crime drop in New York, called The City That Became Safe, which is just brilliant. I mean, he just has a way of thinking about and understanding the roots of complex social phenomena, particularly crime.
1910 West Boulevard.
I'm going to read you a couple of titles of the books he's written over the years. The Scale of Imprisonment, that's from 1991, trying to figure out why are there so many people in American jails. American Capital Punishment, right? The Contradictions of American Capital Punishment, that's from 2003. American Youth Violence from 1998. I mean, so he's been thinking about this for decades now. Anyway, I read that book in 2017 when I was thinking about writing this book, my book, Talking to Strangers, and I hadn't figured out how I was going to write it. And Frank Zimmerman's book just comes out in the middle of that wave of cases. I chose one, Sandra Bland, for my book. And it just made me understand what was going on. And it radicalized me in a really profound way. This is not a kind of aberration. This is not about a few bad apples. This is about something systemic that's gone wrong in our society. And Frank Zimmering was there thinking about this in a profound way long before almost everyone else.
223-10-4.
Malcolm Gladwell recommending When Police Kill by criminologist Frank Zimmering. Gladwell hosts the podcast Revisionist History, and if you'd like to read our in-depth conversation with him, just go to ttbook.org. Coming up, don't give up heart. Policing can change. We'll have the story of the woman who changed how the LAPD are trained. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. In 1991, LA police officers were caught on video beating Rodney King. That ignited massive protests and violent clashes in America. And civil rights attorney Connie Rice decided she'd had enough. And she declared war on the LAPD.
All we were asking for was, please don't humiliate us. Please don't pull us over for no reason. Please don't beat us up for no reason. And LAPD was so brutal and so gang-like back in those days that they couldn't stop themselves from doing all of those things over and over and over again in the Black community, mainly in the Black community.
Connie Rice started suing the LAPD and winning. But police brutality not only did not stop, it increased. She persisted, even in the face of a credible death threat from inside the department. And then the chief of police invited Connie Rice to take 50 cops who worked in one of the city's toughest neighborhoods and retrain them. It worked. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her back in 2014, and he wanted to know what it takes to change police behavior.
How do you change how cops think? Do you just sit down with cops and sit in their car with them and retrain them? That sounds so unrealistic to me.
Right. Well, first of all, you talk to them about the thresholds. Why are you pulling anybody over? Is it just because you saw somebody Black in an expensive car that you didn't think they ought to be driving? Or did they really break a rule that needed to be enforced? So it's the threshold for pulling somebody over, the grounds for pulling somebody over. Then once you've pulled them over, the attitudes with which you address them, how polite you are or impolite. I mean, they used to just speak to people in an awful tone. It was disrespectful. It was full of derision. It was very clear they were out to humiliate people. They would pull people out of their cars and throw them on the ground and prone them out for no reason.
Jeez.
They didn't care if you were in a business suit or in jeans. They would prone people out for absolutely no reason. There's no reason to prone anybody out unless you're about to make an arrest. They weren't going to arrest these people. They just wanted to humiliate them. So you go over every single moment of the encounter with the public and you dissect it. And then you make them go through some practice sessions with how they're going to change their behavior. And yeah, you have to model it. You have to analyze it for them. You have to identify the problem. You have to analyze how you pick it apart and understand what they're doing currently. Then you have to show them what you want them to move to. It's painstaking and it's painful, but that's what it takes to re-engineer and reprogram your cop behavior.
At one point, I think it was in an 18-month period, you interviewed personally, one-on-one, over 900 police officers. What do they say?
They really opened up. They just did a download of all their thoughts and all their fears. And I would hear things like, look, lady, I'm going to be honest with you. Black people scare me. I didn't grow up around black people. I grew up in Antelope Valley. We didn't have any blacks. And I don't really know how to talk to them. Or, lady, black men scare me. And I need help. I mean, I was stunned. Wow. I had to keep the stunned look off of my face, and I could not be judgmental. I had to sit there and listen, and then I had to offer something helpful that told them, look, it's part of the human condition to be afraid of people you're not familiar with. It's also part of the human condition to be wary of people you've never been around. So just accept that as the human condition, and let's move on from there. Now, here are some of the coping skills. Do you want to know how you break down the fear? Well, you hang around with folks. You get to know them. Once you know somebody by their first name, even if it's Pookie, and even if Pookie is a gang member, you know what? Once you sit down and talk to Pookie, once you have breakfast with him every now and then, once you start hanging out with him and play basketball a couple of times a week with him, guess what? You're going to become really relaxed around him, and you're not going to fear him anymore. Because really, while Pookie's a gang member, he's not really one of the bad guys. And you can begin to make those distinctions. And surely and slowly, that's how we did it.
Did you think they were cognizant of the fact that their fear was creating a lot of the violence that was happening in LA from police to black men?
No, I don't think they connected those dots. I think what they realized was that the level of discomfort with blacks meant they had to fix that because they knew they weren't interacting with people in a proper way. They knew that much. They felt so uncomfortable that they actually voiced that fear. And it was enough to voice that fear. And I said, well, that's what's driving your discomfort. And your discomfort is leading to misunderstandings. And the misunderstandings lead to friction, and the friction leads to problems. So they got that much. But I don't think that they connected the dots quite the way you and I would.
But you say you were surprised, almost shocked, at how many times these men talked about being afraid of black men. Did you know that was the issue before you went into it? Or are you really surprised that fear was such a big issue?
I didn't think that fear would be as big of an issue. I knew that unfamiliarity was an issue. I mean, I'm just talking basic familiarity so that you don't startle when a black man walks in the room, or you don't get that heightened heartbeat whenever you see black men.
So Charlie Beck, the LAPD chief, put you in charge of 50 officers to train them, to supervise them. How did you integrate these ideas into their daily job?
We start by saying you're not going to get promoted for how many arrests you make, which is a shock to cops because that's how most cops are promoted. I told these cops, you are not in the arrest business. You are a specialized unit that is in the trust building business. And those cops looked at me like I had really lost my wig.
I bet they thought,
when I told them you are not going to get promoted based on the number of arrests, their eyes got big. I said, in fact, if you make any arrests for minor infractions, including drug infractions that don't harm anybody else and involve no violence, you're going to get dinged for that. You're going to get demerits for that.
Wow.
I am not interested in you dragging in black teenagers for selling a little bit of marijuana. I don't care who's getting high. And I said, I don't care if they're doing small things. You are not to focus on that. That is not what we're about, because that destroys trust. When you throw people on the ground and slap handcuffs on them for, you know, selling a couple of hand-rolled cigarettes like Mr. Garner,
right,
that just totally destroys trust in the police.
Well, how do you promote the officers then that are in your 50 officers in your group? How are they promoted?
They have to demonstrate the relationships they've created with the community. And these are cops who every single day they go into that housing project and they figure out how to serve that population. They have bought 800 pairs of bifocals for the elders who couldn't afford them. They have brought in medical doctors with medical equipment in wagons to test for hypertension and diabetes. They have bought computers for the kids in school. You can't even list all the services they've done. They are building trust through service. Trust through service. And by doing that, they have completely won over these populations. These are hardcore inner city public housing populations who revere these cops because these cops have bent over backwards to serve them. And by serving them, they're helping them to solve problems. And by helping them to solve problems, they're solving crime.
So crime's gone down. Crime's gone down in those neighborhoods?
Crime has plummeted. A 66% reduction in property crimes, a 90% reduction in physical crimes. I'll tell you the stat that bowled me. I had to sit down when I heard this one. There has not been a murder in Nickerson Gardens for 3 years. We used to have a body count weekly in Nickerson Gardens.
Wow.
And for there to be a three-year period with no murders, that's like saying in a brothel there were no sex acts for 3 years.
And anecdotally, you must converse with these officers. Is this a positive experience for them? Are they begrudgingly doing this? Or are they like, I love going to work. I love helping.
Well, in the beginning, it was definitely begrudging.
Right.
It's like, what the hell do these people have me doing? They're ruining my job. And then when they started seeing the public turn around and support them and speak to them and welcome them, introduce them to their kids, I mean, these cops have gotten standing ovations from public housing populations. It's just stunning. I cannot tell you what a turnaround it has been. And so they can't argue with those numbers. They may not like me. One gang officer who doesn't like this model, he called it women's policing. And I said, well, guess what? Get your skirt on because you're getting ready to do it.
That's great. How much more does this cost?
If you talk about a gang murder, which has a lot of retaliation shootings that follow it, a gang murder can cost $1 million to $17 million for each murder, depending on how many retaliation shootings follow the original murder. If you look at the number of murders that have been reduced, the number of shootings that have been reduced, and you calculate the medical costs and the rehabilitation costs, the prosecution costs, the imprisoning costs. If you count all of that up, this program has saved hundreds of millions of dollars for the city of Los Angeles.
This is so positive, and it's such a powerful story, and I've been reading about it for days. But I can imagine there are a lot of people I know who have read the grand jury transcripts of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson. They've seen the video of a 12-year-old, Tamir Rice, playing with a toy gun and being shot. They can hear Eric Garner in their head gasping, I can't breathe. And they hear you saying you're not at war anymore and they want to go to war. What do you say to their anger?
Oh, it's completely understandable. And to be honest, I don't begrudge it one bit. They should be angry and they should be outraged. Now, anger and outrage feel good and sometimes they're necessary outlets in response to an outrageous situation, which many of these shootings are. They're completely outrageous and completely unjustifiable. And if you are a relative of someone who's been murdered under these circumstances, there is nothing that can contain your rage. I understand that. I completely get that. And once you've expressed that rage, you have to ask yourself, okay, what's going to really prevent this from happening again? Well, it isn't going to be your rage. And it isn't going to be the marching, all of which I support. What's going to change it is changing how cops think. Hmm. So here's the deal. We either get in the boat and row with these cops, or we're going to be marching forever, and there are going to be unjustified shootings forever. The question is, what will change how cops behave, how they respond, and how they think? What will help them change? And that's what we have to focus on. And that's what I'm about the business of doing.
Connie Rice is a longtime civil rights attorney in L.A. and a former member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. And if you would like to hear her complete interview with Charles Monroe Kane, you'll find it at ttbook.org. Or you could check out her memoir, Power Concedes Nothing. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced from Madison, Wisconsin at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angela Bautista, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. A word about the music in today's show. It's all from independent African, Afro-Caribbean, and African-American composers, and you can check them out on our website, ttbook.org. And the final word today is from Colson Whitehead and his novel, The Underground Railroad. If you haven't read it, it's the story of Cora, an escaped slave. And there's this one unforgettable scene when Cora has taken a job working in a bizarre living history museum. Her job is to play the character of a slave on a slave ship while visitors watch.
One day she decided to retaliate against a red-haired white woman who scowled at the sight of Cora's duty on the ship. Cora didn't know the source of her animus or care. The woman irked her. Cora stared into her eyes, unwavering and fierce, until the woman broke, fairly running from the glass towards the agricultural section. From then on, Cora selected one patron per hour to evil eye. A young clerk ducking out from his office in the Griffin Building, a man of enterprise. A harried matron corralling an unruly clutch of children. One of the sour youths who liked to batter the glass and startle Cora. Sometimes this one, sometimes that one. She picked the weak links out of the crowd, the ones who broke under her gaze. The weak link. She liked the ring of it. The people she chose, young and old, from the rich part of town or the more modest streets, did not individually persecute Cora. As a community, there were shackles. If she kept at it, chipping away at the weak links wherever she found them, it might add up to something. She got good at her evil eye. They always broke, the people, not expecting this weird attack. It was a fine lesson, Cora thought, to learn that the slave, the African in your midst, is looking at you, too.